Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings to the April episode of Radio Astronomy, listeners. I'm Elizabeth Pearson, the BBC Sky at Night magazine's news editor, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hi.
And staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later in the episode, we'll be talking to Taylor Stone from Delft University about the impact of light pollution, as well as telling you our top stargazing tip to see in this month's night sky. But now we're going to take a look at what we've found out over the last month whilst we've been researching the magazine. So I think I'm going to start off today with all of the exciting news that's been happening in the last couple of weeks from SpaceX.
Yeah.
So cool. They flew their first ever commercial crew module called Crew Dragon up to the ISS and docked and did a bunch of tests, and it all seems to have gone well. Which is great. So this is the first step on the way to the US being able to send astronauts back into space again.
Fantastic news, isn't it? They had a dummy on this latest mission, didn't they?
Yes, it was a mannequin covered in sensors called Ripley, after the
alien protagonist.
Yes.
Yeah.
They do tend to like putting mannequins with names in there. When they first sent up their, I think it was their Falcon Heavy, they had a Tesla on board, which had a mannequin in. And it just, it's like, even though it doesn't have a person in, it does make it seem that sort of a bit more real.
I suppose it makes it kind of a bit more something else you can kind of show the public, you know, something kind of get involved in. But like, was this mission in any way practically advantageous? Did they have supplies on or anything, or any food?
Didn't. It was just, as far as I'm aware, it was just the mannequin and a cuddly toy version of the Earth that was very cute, and it went on little adventures around the ISS, and I got lots of pictures of that. But I think they wanted it to be as realistic as possible, and you wouldn't have supplies on a mission like this. So it's, you don't want to risk jeopardizing your readings, because it is important they make sure that it's, before they start putting people on these things, they want to make sure that it's safe and run it as accurately as possible.
Yeah.
Currently, it's the Soyuz spacecraft that's the only spacecraft going up to the ISS, isn't it?
Yes.
So this is the second one, and it's actually a great thing. It's actually bigger than the Soyuz capsule, isn't it?
By quite, it can carry quite a large seven amount. People, whereas the Soyuz can do three very cramply. It's also much more automated, which means that there's going to be lot shorter training times. So this is one of kind of SpaceX's big goals, is, as well as making all of their spacecraft reusable, the Crew Dragon will eventually be hopefully completely reusable, but by putting more people on it and having shorter training times, it's just all about reducing the cost of space travel. And so that hopefully one day it won't just be, you know, space agencies and the super rich that are going into space. It's it's normal people as well.
And the other great thing is it's got this really cool nose cone, hasn't it, that kind of flips up like a James Bond. That's just awesome. I love that little bit in the video where it was docking and it's went
awesome.
It does definitely look, because the Soyuz capsules were built in the 60s, and they've been developed and refined since then, but they're still very 1960s, you know, lots of sort of switches and things. And then you look inside SpaceX's and also Boeing's, their rival company, Starliner, and they just look so futuristic and what you expect a spacecraft to actually look like in this day and age.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that it is worth pointing out that the Soyuz has been proven to be very reliable, you know, over the decades.
Until a few months ago, I would have agreed with you on that one. Back in late 2018, they had a couple of issues with it. One had to do an emergency launch.
Oh, was that parabolic descent?
Yes,
ballistic descent.
Yes,
wasn't it?
Or, something went wrong during launch, and they had to do a abort mission.
If you can consider the stats and the averages over the decades.
Considering, I think it's like in its entire 40-year run, there's been, you know, like three accidents. Yeah. So that's pretty good going.
That's the other thing about the SpaceX and then the kind of US astronauts launching once more from American soil, is that it's ultimately the end of that collaboration in terms of launching anyway between cosmonauts and astronauts, isn't it? Because I presume you won't have any more have European and US astronauts going to Kazakhstan.
There might be European astronauts.
Who's European?
I don't know too much about what their plans are. I think the US, the ESA are currently locked in for the Soyuz because they knew that that was going to be running and they didn't know when the commercial crew program was going to get off the ground, literally. And but sort of as they go forward, we'll see what happens. Apparently there was some, whilst the Russians seemed to be all smiles, that behind the scenes there was some passive aggressive comments being made towards the US, apparently by some of the Russians.
Oh, right. Okay.
So we'll see how that goes.
The other thing I wanted to actually point out was that the capsule parachuted into the ocean, whereas we have seen SpaceX rockets land again.
Yes.
It didn't happen with this one?
No. It was recovered from the ocean by SpaceX's recovery barge. I think their plan is they still want to reuse the Crew Dragon. They have to give it a bit of a clean because it's got, you know, doused in seawater. But I think it's a little bit too dangerous to, because they have managed to get their booster rockets to land quite a lot, but they do still fall over relatively frequently and, you know, explode in beautiful but fiery balls of flame. And you don't really want to do that if you've got somebody on board. And so it's just much safer and much more reliable to ditch into the ocean. And of course, the SpaceX's ultimate goal is to one day reach Mars and head off in that direction. And we've been hearing a little bit more from Mars lately, haven't we, Ian?
Yes, that actually brings us on quite nicely. This month, as part of the online content, I was speaking to Abigail Freeman, who's the Deputy Project Scientist of the Opportunity rover mission at NASA's JPL. It was big news over the past month because NASA finally called time on the Opportunity mission. Mm. Basically, it was like last summer, there was a global dust storm. Every few years in the summer, Mars gets these dust storms, part of the problem is that the Opportunity rover was a solar paneled rover, so that obviously blocks out the sunlight and stops it from operating. But even when the dust storm cleared, they still couldn't get transmission back from it, so they had to basically call time on it in February, so just in the last month. But I mean, it landed on Mars in 2004. It was only supposed to go for 90 days, and it was like about 14 and a half years.
They do tend to make things to last at NASA. Yeah.
That's brilliant. They built in a lot of redundancy there.
Yeah.
Now, doubtless there will be some satellite images from the Mars Express or something in the future showing they will have found it. They know where and this is zooming in, you can see a little tiny speck. And
hopefully.
This will be Opportunity's final resting place.
Yeah, you would imagine.
They did it for Beagle, didn't they? They found
the
Beagle probe.
So,
the UK
yes.
Beagle probe on Mars.
The problem is it depends on how much dust is on Opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. It might be buried in a massive sand dune or something. You never know.
I think one of the things that it was sort of bittersweet, but apparently its last transmission was words to the effect of my battery is low and I'm running and it's getting dark or something.
Oh,
it was
in
engineering speak, but as you saw that one sort of going round.
It sounds like it could be the chorus of a Bowie tune or something.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I mean, it must actually be quite emotional. I mean, I was speaking to Abigail Freeman, as I say, for the interview for this month's online content, and she kind of makes the point that it is kind of like an emotional attachment. She actually was a 16-year-old college student visiting NASA as part of an outreach program when Opportunity landed.
Goodness
and
me.
Now, you know, a decade or so later, she's the Deputy Project Scientist. So it's actually
that's
quite
brilliant.
An interesting story. And there's kind of like a lot of humanity behind these NASA
that's,
missions.
Yeah. One of the things that I really like about the NASA Mars missions is because you see it over and over again. There was people who saw the previous one and that's what made them go into space science. And then they're working on the next one. It's, you know, the people who were on Voyager ended up working on Pathfinder. The people on Pathfinder, like, got inspired by Pathfinder, went on to do the rovers. And you can just see the sort of baton being passed down through history.
Yeah, and I suppose it also, you know, kind of makes the point of why it's so important to do things like outreach programs for young people to kind of see, you know, and people decide that's what I want to do with my life, and then they become the new generation. But it's also worth kind of talking about exactly what the rovers do on Mars. I mean, Opportunity was effectively a robotic geologist. Mm-hmm. One of the things it did was looked at rocks, really, and it could actually grind into them and expose surfaces and you know, analyze them, basically. And it's all part of working out what Mars was like in its ancient past. You know, 3 billion years ago, I think its climate was a lot different. Could have potentially had, mm-hmm. you know, well, I think it's pretty much conclusive that it had water in its ancient mm-hmm. past.
It's, I think
there's so much evidence, isn't there?
Yeah, the Mars Exploration Rovers, which is what Spirit and Opportunity's real name is, they were very much part of NASA's Follow the Water initiative, which is on Mars. If you want to find potentially life, if you want to understand the geology of how these planets grow, the first thing you need to do is follow the water. Mm-hmm. So that's what it did.
Yeah, and now the only rover left is Curiosity, but there's going to be a whole ream of
new ones joining soon, aren't they?
Yeah, and
just as well, because Curiosity's been having a few issues as well lately.
That's right. Had like a hiccup. Had to reset its software.
Yes. About again last summer during the dust storms, it had some computer upset in September, and then it needed to have an emergency reset. And it seems to be going all right, but it's, you know, it's slightly more computer glitches than the people at NASA are entirely comfortable with. So it's just as well that we're getting in 2020 not one but two rovers heading over towards Mars.
Yes, exactly. Mm. And speaking of planetary science, Chris, you've been looking at some results from the Juno mission. And
yeah, that's right. In our back page interview in the April issue, we've got an interview with Dr. Lee Fletcher from the University of Leicester, who is a collaborator with the Juno team, which is NASA's probe around Jupiter. And he's got some really interesting, he's been doing some really interesting stuff with the results that are coming in from Juno. And kind of pairing it up with observations from Earth and seeing how weather and cloud and other formations develop on Jupiter, which is amazing because, you know, we can only see the top, the very top of the cloud and Jupiter, and it's a planet without any ground. Without a hard surface, so you know who knows what's going on underneath.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Juno is doing for the first time is it's giving us the ability to look into Jupiter underneath the clouds. I mean, everybody knows with Juno, the Juno Cam, which sends back these fabulous kind of tie-dye marble type images.
I love
of clouds,
those pictures.
Which are amazing.
They're
so
beautiful.
And Lee Fletcher is saying that his favourite instrument on Juno is the microwave instrument, which is the thing that allows him to see under the clouds and see what is cooking up underneath. And it's just, I could, you know, it's just one of these things. It's a great unknown, isn't it? It's like, you know, the Marianas Trench on Earth or something.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on?
I remember
in there. I mean, there's such weird stuff, isn't there? Like the metallic hydrogen and things like that. It's a really, really freaky environment.
I remember a couple of years ago, I was writing a feature about the Great Red Spot, which is this, it's this thing, it's been on Mars. We've known it's there for like 150 years, probably longer.
Far longer, yeah.
And we have no idea what's going on beneath the surface.
Exactly.
I remember we were trying to get an illustration of sort of like the cross section of it.
Yes.
And basically, it ended up being we don't know what's going on under there.
Yeah.
And so I think it's great that you've got these instruments that now can sort of go beneath the surface and try and find out what's going on about the weather of
Yeah, absolutely. Jupiter. It's absolutely amazing. And he's saying that he can kind of track cloud formations from the ground. And now he's got this data set from Juno that allows him, and he can match up observations from Earth with kind of infrared telescopes with these microwave readings from Juno and see what the kind of processes that are going on, you know, at deeper levels on Jupiter and how they relate to what's happening up above, which is a fascinating thing. And it's allowing us to build up a picture of how weather on gas giants operates. And, you know, that can help with exoplanets, that can help with, you know, predicting the weather on our own planet.
I should imagine it also helps with the sun as well, because that's just
Yeah, that's
basically just another big weather system.
Yeah, that's right, ball of gas.
I think the thing that, because I sort of always forget that, you know, sort of weather just doesn't happen in, like, there's not like, this is where the cloud is and that's everything. It goes right the way down and it all interacts with each other and it's all just this big, ridiculously complicated mess.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a very different environment to Earth. I mean, there isn't, there aren't any, there's no ground, there's no ocean. So, you know, there's no kind of drivers for change there. And it's probably, you know, kind of a lot more magnetic and electrical. And there's nothing that can stop any, once something started, this thing can just go on, which hence why we see the Great Red Spot. It's been going on for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years.
And also shrinking, if I remember.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
It's shrinking and changing colour, I believe. It changes colour quite a lot.
Yeah.
But
it's becoming less red, isn't it?
Yeah, there's apparently, there was another storm which they thought might become the next Great Red Spot. But I think that one's also trying to shrink as well. It'd be sad to see if it does go. But, you know, that's weather. These things happen.
There we are. Yes. Yeah. Yes, they run out eventually, don't they?
It seems a bit odd that, you know, that's kind of like one of the main features of Jupiter can just go away. Sort of like if suddenly, you know, Australia disappeared off Earth.
Yeah. Or just slowly disappeared over time.
Yeah.
Even weirder.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose that brings us on to this month's interview, because Earth Hour is approaching at the end of this month on the 30th of March. At 8:30 p.m. UK time, it is Earth Hour, and this is an annual campaign, a worldwide campaign, in which the organisers ask everyone to turn off their lights for an hour at the same time, and basically to raise awareness of light pollution, and get people thinking about darkness and whether or not artificial light is kind of, we're kind of missing something, especially in towns and cities, and, you know, in terms of the fact that we can't see, you know, the Milky Way. Maybe we miss the phases of the moon and things like that. And I've been speaking to Taylor Stone of Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. He researches the ethics behind artificial light and light pollution. So I started off by asking him whether he thought that light pollution was a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of increasing recognition of just the negative and adverse impacts that nighttime lighting has. From a variety of perspectives, including on our health and on ecosystems. But also, I think one of the sort of the most striking numbers that people often use are just the economic costs and energy usage. There's been some estimates that just the cost of wasted light in the European Union can be upwards of 5 billion euros a year, and something like 23 billion kilograms of CO2 emissions. And so, you know, you can debate whether these numbers are exact or not. But I think what it shows is just the scale of the impact of this infrastructure that we have and the negative impacts that it can produce that we need to pay attention to.
When you say wasted light, what exactly do you mean by that?
It's more of a technical question, I would say. What we consider to be wasted light? So light shone upwards or not used for its intended purpose. And I think you can sort of debate so what we mean by wasted light. But I think the underlying this is just the scale of the impact of lighting and the cost and energy usage it has is sort of the important takeaway, I would say.
I mean, obviously, from our perspective, we're kind of interested in how light pollution affects the amount of stars that we can see in the night sky. Is there a way of kind of quantifying that? Can you kind of say how fewer stars or the effects of our view of the night sky that light pollution actually has?
Well, I think, of course, anecdotally, we all sort of know when we live in cities or travel to these sort of metropolitan regions and look up, you can see, I mean, there's, you know, at best on a clear sky, there's a few dozen stars available versus when you're in a sort of a pristine night sky, the difference it makes. But yeah, I think in 2016, the latest, the World Atlas of Artificial Night Sky Brightness was released. And their conclusions were that, you know, 99% of the population in the European Union or in Europe live in areas that are considered to have light polluted skies. And most people live in areas where it's several magnitudes greater. To the point that something like 3/5, so about 60% of the population, can no longer see the Milky Way.
And I suppose this must be a pretty recent problem in the history of humanity. I mean, can you kind of say when light pollution starts becoming a massive problem in history?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is kind of it's quite a fascinating issue to think about lighting infrastructure in that sense, because electric light is we sort of take it to be we take it for granted as this sort of everyday experience that's always been there, but really it's only been possible at this scale for a few generations. And so light pollution as a concept and as a problem really only emerged in the last few decades, I think, alongside rising environmental movements and so on. And so there's always been concerns going back some time about the effects, the negative effects around things like glare and otherwise that electric light can have. But this idea of light pollution, that light can somehow be polluting ourselves, polluting the environment, is a relatively recent sort of phenomenon or categorization, I would say.
And do you think that there is that it actually has an effect on people who live in cities, that, you know, the fact that they can't actually see the Milky Way, or, you know, they maybe don't take as much notice of things like the faces of the moon? They might not be aware of it, but do you think that there is an effect on us as a society?
So I think that's, it's an interesting and an open-ended question. And I think you see it even in scientific papers looking at the effects or extent of light pollution. You see this sort of idea that, you know, the night sky has been the source of inspiration of religion, mythology, navigation, culture, and so on for all of human history. And in certain parts of the world, we've effectively cut ourselves off from this experience in just a matter of a few generations. So what exactly the long-term effects and impact on society is I think, an open question. But I think you can think about it also from the perspective of environmental ethics. And this idea that the access to a starry night sky or an unpolluted night sky can be a sort of truly sublime experience, and sort of take ourselves out of our daily lives and to be able to sort of be in this situation and immersed in the natural world in a way that we can't put ourselves outside of or above of. And so there at least exists a possibility there to foster some sort of an environmental ethic, or at least see sort of the impact of our lighting in a different light.
Yeah, but just also putting kind of astronomy and stargazing aside, there must be other issues with light pollution. And one of the things I was thinking about was this idea that for millennia, both humans and animals have lived with it being light at daytime and dark at nighttime, and that's kind of our natural cycle. But that must be being upset a bit by the kind of pervasion of light pollution in cities. Are you aware of kind of detrimental effects in that respect, both for humans and for animals?
I think for ecosystems and wildlife and so on, the effects of this sort of rapidly changing levels of illumination at night have been quite studied, and it's a relatively new field, but it's being increasingly studied, the effects on different flora and fauna, whether it's positive or negative, usually negative. To use the term detrimental to humans, I mean, there's health effects that we have to deal with. But then there's these larger sort of changes that we've undergone in moving towards this 24/7 societies and always having access to different services and mobility at night. And so there are negative effects, there are positive effects. I think it's sort of a condition of modern urbanized life to live in this new sort of environment where we have created this new space out of artificial illumination. And so I'm always a bit hesitant to use detrimental too broadly. But I think it's worth reflecting on just the extent of these impacts and taking a step back and asking what is needed and what is desirable about this. And this can help lead us towards questions of how much light we actually want and need at night.
Yeah, that's true, because I suppose lots of people would think of things like security. You know, if someone's walking home late at night, then light helps them be visible and make them feel safer and perhaps even be safer. I mean, is it about reaching a compromise, do you think?
Yeah, I think compromise would be a good way to look at it. Because there's, of course, I think any dark sky advocate would agree that there are instances where we want and need light at night, right? And then I think anyone who sort of, you stop on the street, hasn't thought about this, after a 5-minute conversation, they could agree that, you know, okay, maybe we have too much light. There's instances where we could get rid of it. Seeing the night sky would be great, or otherwise, or, you know, even reducing my energy bill would be great. And then there's, of course, this big gray area in between. And so compromise is one way, but I think another way we can look at it is as a policy and design challenge. Because, you know, there are a lot of studies out there that contest this idea that more light actually increases safety and security. But I think it's pretty undeniable that lighting at night often makes us feel safer in cities. And so there's this question of then how can we design our spaces that can satisfy both these goals of environmental values or reduction in light pollution or access to a night sky and make sure people feel and are in fact safe at night, both you know, in terms of feeling safe walking around, but also just practically safe so they don't trip on things or you know, in places where there are cars and people, where we make sure that pedestrians are visible and so on. And I think this is where new and emerging technologies and smart systems and ideas of responsive lighting, if we can sort of think about these as opportunities to design in these sort of environmental values and to satisfy these different goals of safety and environmental values or reducing light pollution, there are some exciting opportunities ahead.
On the 30th of March, there's a campaign called Earth Hour, mm-hmm. when people are invited all over the world at the same time to turn off their lights for an hour, I suppose, as a way of raising awareness of light pollution and darkness. I just wanted to gauge your thoughts on this. Do you think things like this are important, or do you think they're kind of a show and don't actually have a good effect? I was wondering what your thoughts would be on something like Earth Hour.
As you just said, I think what's quite interesting about Earth Hour is that, you know, as we had discussed a bit earlier about this, the history of lighting and how we take it to be just sort of the way things are, we take it for granted. It's just in the backdrop. These are moments that are quite interesting where we refocus on lighting and these, and sort of making these purposeful blackouts, let's say. And then lighting almost becomes symbolic of the environmental impact that our urban development or humans have on the earth, which is quite interesting and I think important that we can see lighting in this way. I mean, I think the nice stuff about something like Earth Hour is, you know, that, well, one, it has a sense of community. It can bring people together for a common cause, and also it can help to raise awareness, not just about lighting, but more broadly about our impacts. I think the biggest takeaway I would see from this is this idea that, you know, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a solution, but it gives us an opportunity to take a step back from our daily lives and see things otherwise, see and start to think about how we could live differently, how our cities could be designed differently, and sort of use this for inspiration and to start thinking creatively about what sort of future we want.
That was Taylor Stone. Find out more about what you can do to help curb light pollution in this month's explainer in the April issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. There's lots to see in the night sky, and you can find all about it in this month's Sky Guide. But if you're looking for one single thing to single out this month, why not look towards the Pleiades? You can find this star cluster quite easily as Orion's belt points the way. Follow the line drawn by the belt upwards with your naked eye, past Taurus, until you see a patch of haze with several bright stars. Once you've located it with your eyes, take a closer look with a pair of binoculars. If you take a look during the first half of April, you should be able to see the bright reddish light of Mars as it passes by the cluster. So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about fighting light pollution at home in the April issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also look at astronomy you can do from inside your own house, give tips for selecting your first telescope, and learn about the incredible legacy of NASA's planet-hunting telescope, Kepler. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky Night Magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.